It was a $50 million payday, and it was supposedly DPRK, so North Korea doing this. They found someone who had left the organization recently, and they impersonated them. And, I mean, we've all, you know, worked at places and had people come and go. If somebody left and then they reached out to you, I mean, it's a perfect prescript, right? Because they can come to you from any Outlook or Gmail. And you're like, oh, well, that must be Joe's personal email address, right? I only talked to him at work, and now he's gone. Of course it's a new email address. It's just really perfect.
The Adversarial Podcast. Why you gotta be so adversarial? It's time to get adversarial.
Welcome back to the Adversarial Podcast. Thanks everyone for tuning in. Mario, Sunil, good to see you guys. We are recording this just before the holidays, just before Christmas specifically. Time will tell whether people listen to podcasts more when they're on break or less, but we want to have it ready. Good to see you guys. What are you up to? Are you guys getting any, Sunil, I'm going to predict you're going to stay home and not travel?
Yes. After 4 weeks of international travel across six countries, I think, I'm good to stay home. And while I was in Tel Aviv, it was my first time actually being there during an air raid, some missile alert. So
oh, wow. What exciting. Was that like?
It was very non-eventful. Not that that's a bad thing, but we were all shuffled into some place where we would not get harmed, and then 5 minutes later, we all left.
Wow. Yeah. Well, Mario, what are you going to be up to? Are you going to be around?
No, I'm actually going to visit family, and we're going to be visiting Colorado. And sometimes it gets cold and snowy, so or sometimes it's sunny. That's what Colorado is all about. And all I know is I sit on my butt and eat a lot and read a lot, and then I gain a lot of weight in the next week or two. I've been training for this.
Fantastic. Yeah, I'll be around as well. So jumping right into it, you know, we were chatting about the topics and what to talk about, and one kind of macro topic that I think warrants time at any given point is, especially in the U.S. with the incoming administration, how things might change. And in particular, there's two things with regard to cybersecurity that people are thinking about a lot. And one of them is those SEC rules around public companies and required disclosures. And I think people were kind of taking shots at that rule set a while back, and it wasn't getting a lot of press because generally it was more bipartisan. People were either excited about it or willing to tolerate it. And now the thought is that, you know, people might take a shot at that and say it's interfering with business, that it's unnecessary burden to have to disclose cyber breaches in accordance with the SEC rule set. So one question is whether that will get rolled back, and not just with the incoming administration, but like a knock-on effect from new SEC chair and onward. And then the other is CISA, right? Jenna Easterly is set to resign. I think I said it, I read it, it's inauguration day is the way that works out. You could read that as either someone else is going to be appointed or no one's going to be appointed, or just that, you know, that it's going to look a lot different. So that'll be interesting to pay attention to. What are your thoughts, maybe in starting with CISA? How do you feel about how they've performed over the last few years and how helpful they are or aren't? Are there things that should be changed? And would you lament it if they're wound back significantly and budget is cut?
Oh, it's a new agency, so any new agency will have growing pains, right?
2018, is that right?
Yeah. The only person that would not have want to have run CISA is Rudy Giuliani, which was, I think, in Trump 1.0, his cyber advisor. So hopefully Rudy stays out of the space and doesn't touch CISA. But that said, I think the people who are actually truly under real consideration, I looked at the names, and they're legit cybersecurity people. So I think I would not be too concerned if in terms of who Trump picks for leading CISA, assuming that it continues to exist as an agency. Cybersecurity is a bipartisan issue, so I don't see enough support for getting rid of CISA. I think we all agree that it could be potentially better in various ways, but how it could be better, I don't know if I have a particular opinion on it. I just accept that I don't want Rudy Giuliani, the one to lead it.
I'm a fan of CISA because I think they really are trying to, it may not be applicable to everybody and every vertical. And I know, Jerry, you have strong opinions about these verticals, certain verticals, but I think a lot of what they write can be applicable to a lot of companies, to most companies, I would argue. And at least somebody's trying to do something. At least somebody's trying to provide some guidelines as a governing body and advice. So I'm a big fan of CISA. I would hate to see them go. Yes, they could improve. They could be better.
So first of all, I got a real big issue here. Is it CISA, CISA, or CISA?
I'll take number one or two. I just three. I'm ruling out three. That's all I'll give you.
I mean, this will settle a lot of other arguments, I would say.
I've seen two kind of mandates out of there, and one is critical infrastructure, which is a proper noun, right? There's a formal designation, and people don't realize that a lot, and a lot of times people just think it means important infrastructure, and therefore the guidance applies to everybody, but that's not necessarily true. And then the other is the other end of the spectrum, which is the entire United States and mom and pop and the public. And it's always like, I wish they were more clear about that, about who's talking to the public and who's talking to the very tip of the spear in critical infrastructure. Because if you mix the two, you have some of this guidance and threat intelligence that comes out that's very relevant if you're operating a dam, but a hydroelectric dam. But you don't need to burden mom and pop and everyone with that. And I think that's been a little bit confusing under them. That has nothing to do with the incoming administration and burning the house down or anything else like that. I just feel like they could have stood some clarity of remit a few times over the last couple of years.
Yeah, and I can understand the challenge there. I mean, because they do have a remit around critical infrastructure. But at the same time, I think many of us do look at CISA as the authoritative agency. I mean, in fact, we see them as the cybersecurity agency of the United States. And so I think whether you're big or small, you know, whether you're a Section 9 company or not, you'll still say, hey, what sort of guidance can they give me? So I think it has to, even though their remit officially is only for, you know, is towards their critical infrastructure space, I think they have to embrace the expectation that many others are going to look to them for guidance.
I have interacted with some of the CISA folks, and I find them to be really caring about the state of security and helping the country. I found them to be extremely knowledgeable, right? Especially when we got into, you know, cloud and SaaS. I'm often arrogant. I'm thinking these government folks don't know what, you know, the cloud or SaaS or the newer technologies. And it always surprises me how knowledgeable they are, how much they understand the space. And quite honestly, they don't make a lot of money. They don't make a lot of money. They could go work for the Valley or work for one of those big financial companies in the East Coast and, you know, quadruple their salary. These folks really, the ones who I interacted with, really do care about the country and about the industry as a whole.
Yeah. Yeah, and you know what? I mean, from what I remember, they only got themselves negative attention because of election interference and misinformation. And I'm saying they did either of those things. But, you know, when they just came out and said, hey, there's interference with the election, people went after them and said that they were colluding with big tech to disrupt the election. And now here we are with the potential for budget to be pulled on them when I think they were pretty middle of the road and trying to be pretty objective about everything. So I think it'd be a shame for that to happen. And I don't see it as being a massive drain. And it's not. I mean, speaking from somewhat experience for regulated entities and designated critical infrastructure, where they did have a say, they were nothing. I mean, no regulatory burden whatsoever. They were always on offer to help. They were discreet. There was no threat of anything that you did with them, you know, leaking or causing a competitive disadvantage or anything commercial. So, now the SEC, on the other hand, or CFTC or specific regulators, yeah, that's where you actually have a regulatory and examination burden, the FFIEC 10 times over. But CISA has always been pretty clean and pure, so I don't believe in the argument of them getting out of the way of business.
Yeah, and in the regard to, they don't see themselves generally as a regulatory agency, right? But I think the CERCIA, the critical cybersecurity incident respond, I forget the acronym. But
I thought you were going to make it through it.
Report within a certain time frame. You know, certainly starts looking like regulation. And in fact, I think that's how I would have perceived it as well. I think part of the general question that we should be asking ourselves and that the SEC should be asking ourselves is, yes, we want to make sure that shareholders have all the material information that's needed to be able to make good investment decisions. But I think we have seen time and time again that a breach really has basically no material effect on a company, and so, or has very limited material effect on a company. And in many cases, it bounces right back pretty quickly after an event. So if the premise is that a cybersecurity breach has a material impact and thus investors should be aware of it, but that's actually not true, then should we continue to make reporting a mandatory requirement because it's a material incident? If it is truly material, then what actually would what's the evidence that we need to be able to demonstrate it is truly material? And so far, again, stock price doesn't seem to be a strong indicator there.
Yeah, I agree with that. So, yeah, I guess I conflated two different things. CISA is one thing, but SEC, and in particular, these rules around disclosures. And look, that was driven, I would say, by public uproar. I mean, a lot of the regs around cyber, in particular around PII disclosure, were driven by the companies don't have an organic motivation to share this, but it hurts the individual consumers, so we want to let them know. And then you project that onto the SEC's constituents, shareholders, investors, and it was saying there's not an organic motivation to inform shareholders, but it may hurt something big down the road, so let's let them know. I think everyone agrees there's some place where it's better safe than sorry. I'll use a good example, insider sales, right? Everybody is disclosing every transaction by an insider, even if it's for $5,000. No one's in a rush to, well, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think anybody's in a rush to pull those out of the public record. So maybe this is akin to that, and shareholders all hear about it, and maybe it doesn't move the stock, and that's fine, but you want to let them make the decision.
Okay, well, so let's talk about this a bit further. Certainly, insider sales absolutely is a strong indicator that's necessary for reporting. But let's talk about a breach of records, right? A breach of someone stored a whole bunch of social security numbers of their customers, and that gets breached. Is that going to have a material impact on anybody? I'm sorry, let me, in case you haven't come to realize this, your social security numbers are already out there, widely available, either through a breach or through all these data brokers anyway. So who cares, right? National public data, whatever, right? My point is that the fact that you had a breach, okay, maybe then you have to, here's a question I wonder. You've gotten, I'm sure at this point, more than a dozen, hey, your data has gotten lost, please sign it. We will give you this free service, okay? Out of 10 of those that you've received, how many of those did you actually sign up for? Like, did you actually get that free service?
Okay. Sounds dangerous. Right.
My point is that, I mean, we have a lifetime's worth of that service if we ever want it, right? And I don't think everyone signs up for every one of those. So when you get a breach, and you have to, you know, send out this notice and sign up all your customers for it, it's only a small fraction of them actually sign up, and so your actual losses under a breach is significantly lower.
Yeah. I mean, I think the threats around, like, data breach and PII breach in particular, I think there's two main things. And one is that reputational, and will customers leave because they don't trust you? That hasn't really borne out, for better or worse. And then the other is just the fines. It's just a straight up fines under privacy regulation. Because absent those fines, I'm with you. It's not only immaterial; it's kind of inconsequential. And it's not like fraud loss. If a major bank is losing $2 million a month, it's immaterial. Doesn't really matter. But it is $2 million a month. With a PII loss, it's not only immaterial; it won't hit them in the wallet. But there's not even like a de minimis impact. There's nothing at all. So the privacy regs step in to say, since they don't care at all, and they shouldn't for their shareholder obligations, we want to let the public know, and we want to fine you if you do it. And then those fines ostensibly could become material.
Jerry, you've educated me on this whole SEC and you know, the whole thing as an investor, as a value to the investors, and that's really what their focus was, right? To keep the investors informed. And I appreciate that piece of information. You've kept us informed on that. So thank you. The big thing for me is it's this whiplash thing that happens in business when you get these regulations or things that happen. And most of us went through it, and maybe our listeners also have gone through this whole SEC. My goodness, the amount of hours that we've spent on this crap in the last 2 years, And now it's all of a sudden to pull it and just get rid of it. It's, I think business like predictability and some consistency, folks. Okay, I think we're getting more used to this whole SEC notification. And we built all these processes. Companies have built all these processes, all this documentation, all these notifications. There are businesses built on this, to, you know, companies that are building services behind this. And now we're pulling the plug on it. And I just, that whiplash, that's not healthy for business, folks. You want some sort of predictability, in my opinion. So I'm not a big fan of this whole SEC notification, et cetera, but now that we're doing it, goodness, and now pulling all that, and then what's going to happen? The next administration, 4 years from now, if it's a Democratic administration, are they going to enforce it again? That doesn't seem healthy to me.
Painful. Yeah. Yeah, I do think, like, it's funny. I saw some article that was talking about things that are likely to gain the stage when it comes to cyber in the next 3 months. And it was saying, it seemed to be really written by a human, not algorithmically. And it was saying that there's bipartisan support for A, regulatory harmonization around cybersecurity, and then separately B, healthcare regs around cyber standards, which to me are a complete odds. Like, you want to have harmonization, so let's create a whole new set of standards for a specific vertical. But, you know, being under, having lived through a lot of the regs, I do think it's not a very effective state of affairs right now when it comes to cyber regulation in industries that are specifically regulated. So not like SEC over public companies or FTC over privacy regs, but more like actual sector-specific regulators. Them all reinventing the wheel and FFIEC over banking and trying to come up with frameworks and just say, this is what everybody should do. And then you mint that, and it takes years to even get into law, and then years before it's revised. And meanwhile, the threat actors are moving so fast, it gets stale. So if one good thing can change, I think having a harmonization effort that just says, let's stop talking about sector-specific controls and things like that and just have more, you know, threat-centric controls, and then the sectors just say, follow that. We want you to follow that. We're going to examine you against that.
One ring to rule them all.
Well, there's an interesting dynamic already happening within the EU around what's called NIS2, which is a piece of legislation that was passed many, many years ago, but it's supposed to start going into effect next year, I think it is. And the perspective here is that each country is supposed to come up with their own sort of legislation around you know, the requirements of cybersecurity. So imagine the sector-specific harmonization is one thing. Talk about country-specific, or EU-wide harmonization. That's going to be an interesting challenge. So if you're trying to do business in the EU, you may end up with this patchwork of different rules that you have to follow depending upon what country you're trying to do business in. So you can imagine that harmonization effort being a big challenge in and of itself, let alone the sector-specific ones.
Yeah. But you know, you guys, well, some of you were in the banking industry, and at one point, I think there were some different state regulations for banks that were stringent, more stricter than other ones. And I remember when we were doing business across the country in the States, you would pick the one with the strictest rules. I suspect if you're doing business in the EU covering multiple countries, and some of them, you know, some of them are losers, some of them are more stricter, you're probably, as a company, going to go with the more stricter one, because, again, you want predictability. You want repeatable. You don't want to be thinking, oh, that country is stricter, but that one's looser. You're going to go with the stricter one. That tends to be where I think things go.
Yeah, it's interesting whether regulation becomes an arbitrage standpoint and a competitive bit, you know. I mean, we have the same thing with privacy laws in the U.S., right, on a state-by-state level. And for some entities, they might prefer stricter rules, but if you're the ones bound by them and producing around them, it might be the total opposite. So, yeah, regulatory arbitrage, that's a thing. Yeah. So speaking of, it's not CISA necessarily, but DHS, there was some guidance that came out after some telecom network related attacks, and So, Neil, I think you have some better info on the background of some of these attacks and what's capable and go through that. But I would like to talk after that about some of the recommendations that have come out in the light of what is the audience of DHS and who's reading this and are these things all the right things to be telling people?
Yeah, so a couple things have hit the news recently that's worth noting. There is Salt Typhoon and their presence inside telecom networks. And then more recently, DHS also mentioned that you have all these countries spying on us through the SS7 network. So let's talk about those. They're kind of related, but let's unpack both of those. So first of all, the SS7 network, for those who aren't familiar, it's called the Signaling 7 network. If you recall back in the day, there's all these all this hacker lore where you could blow a Captain Crunch whistle into a phone and get free telephone calls and all that kind of stuff. And that was because at the time, signaling or the control system was in band. And we said, okay, that's probably not a good idea. We should make it out of band. And so the SS7 network was born, and it was an out-of-band communications channel. The out-of-band communications channel worked really well when you had a whole bunch of trusted players like MCI, AT&T, Sprint, and so on and so forth. But once the telco deregulation kicked in and you had all these what we'll call the CLECs, I forget what the C stands for, but the individual carriers that were really just, it could have been almost fly-by-night companies started popping up, they needed access to, guess what, the signaling network. In other words, they needed access to a trusted network, or at least to a network that we thought everyone was trusted, and of course, that's not true. So now expand that into a much more larger global environment, and you have this, what was previously a trusted network, now introducing all these potentially untrusted players. So lo and behold, now guess what you can do? You can take advantage of this control environment in nefarious ways. Oh, by the way, I should mention, the SS7 network is also the same network that we use to transmit SMS. So the signal, the packets that we use to transmit the signaling messages also has enough of a buffer where we can insert a text message or any arbitrary message. That message, by the way, I think that buffer is like 140 characters. So if you ever wondered why text messages only could store 140 characters, that's why. But anyway... okay, so all that, and by the way, that message is also in the clear. Okay, so if you're on the SS7 network, guess what? You can also read everyone's SMS too. So that's why we're seeing guidance that says, hey, don't transmit 2FA, or don't, if you have anything sensitive that you're trying to transmit, then don't send it over SMS because it's available for anyone to read. And there's two ways to, there are a couple ways to read it. One is to have presence on the SS7 network, like a listening node, let's say. And I think that's kind of, there's a way to intercept that through like, you know, lawful intercept type of things. But then there's also ways to hijack the communications over the SS7 network because you can spoof who you are. If you've ever had a situation where you got a call from a number that purports to be someone that you know or a company that you think is legit, it's because there's SS7 spoofing attacks or hijacking attacks that are now well understood by attackers and being exploited. So anyway, those are all the different issues with SS7. If you're familiar with BGP and some of the challenges with BGP routing, it's the same sort of thing, except that BGP is for the internet and the SS7 is for the telco networks.
The way you painted that out, I mean, makes me think about like intelligence-led defenses. And so, you know, you're certainly laid out a pretty good idea of what's theoretically possible on those. And when we talk about like SMS interception, like you were saying, the I'm going to call it the cells, the payloads, whatever it may be, are in the clear to people who can intercept that on the network. And so if, for example, a one-time SMS code was intercepted, it could be played back. I've certainly heard about SIM hijacking, and I take over your number, so I get the code, and then I have it. That's a real threat and why we've told people to deprecate SMS-based one-time passwords. But what I think you were intimating in a way was somebody could just good old intercept it, so they don't have to take over your phone number, see it, and then they get in there. I've never heard that happening, though. I, and like my whole mantra here is I feel like people can be second to market on cyber. Like you don't need to be ready to be patient zero. You can let somebody else fall over and we can just wait till that happens and then take action and not worry about it until then. Am I right? Or has that ever happened where people are intercepting that yet? And if so, is that enough reason to wait or should people act?
Well, in terms of, there used to be an app that you can install and run that says basically spoof any number, call from someone else's number. So that's an example of an SS7 attack that has been commoditized to a point where you can install an app and basically pick anybody's number.
But just to be clear, it has nothing to be able to be on the inside network, compromise the actual network, read the contents of the network, right? That's just
That's because you have a malicious player, a bad actor that is now part of the SS7 network who can basically intercept or do this, do these types of interceptions for you. So those are completely legit. They're not theoretical attacks. These are real attacks that in some cases have been commoditized. And whenever we see bad actors like that, you know, in theory, we're supposed to boot them out. Just as much as we're supposed to boot out things like the Russian business network off the internet. You know, good luck with that, right? I wouldn't say that these are theoretical attacks. These are real attacks that we have seen and have been commoditized into like a mobile app.
Yeah, but like, so I get phone calls all the time that pretend to be from the locale that they want me to think they're in, right? And especially the wholesale mortgage brokers, right? You're interested in selling the property. It always comes from your local number. It takes, you know, 3,000 to 4,000 milliseconds to connect. There's this very international flavor to it. And it feels like it gets dynamically routed to someone who didn't expect that call to be coming. They pick up the line and say some generic little script. So they're impersonating, and that's a commoditized service they were able to buy, I guess, and use an Atlanta number, Florida, whatever it is. Yes. But there's no reason to think that level of access would allow them to intercept an SMS code going across.
That's not an SS7 attack. That's just somebody who's doing different call routing. So someone sets up a whole bunch of VoIP nodes all over the world, all over the country, and they're calling through that. That's not an SS7 attack. As far as I know, that's not one. This used to be available on an app store where you could do call spoofing, where you're, again, spoofing somebody else's actual number. That is an SS7 attack.
We talked about social security numbers being exposed on the public internet. Okay, got it. And your date of birth, got it. Okay, fine. Would you be okay, Jerry, if your text messages were publicly available? All your text messages?
No.
Sunil?
No. But at the same time, I've known about text messages being in the clear for a long, long time.
Yep.
So, the question is there anything on my text messages, something I actually care about? And the answer is generally no. So maybe let me retract my comment earlier and say, I would say for the bulk of, if not nearly all my text messages, you know, the green bubble, so to speak, I'm like, no, there's nothing sensitive on any of those.
I'm not worried about like what I'm going to, I think we're professionals. We probably know what we should be typing or not, but I think I worry about my kids. I worry about other folks that may not be so guarded in their text messaging. I think the clear text has always been there. We get that. It's just when you start adding players like China, Russia, and Iran into the mix. Okay. I'm keeping Israel out of it. But as you see, these are our adversaries. China, Russia, and Iran are not our friends. Having access to information, text messages from, you know, the public, the American public, is something that I would be concerned with, right? And if they have access.
So, like, your premise was it okay to put it on the public internet? No, not at all. And then we go to, therefore, you should use Signal. But I think that connection is flawed because the fact that there are clear text in some network that some privileged actors can read to it is very different from being on the public internet. And if the things that I might put in text, but by the way, there's not much I wouldn't put in text. Like, would I text you, here's, I could even text you a private key that you could use to unlock $10,000 of crypto right now. I'd be fine with that. The people who want that aren't in that network right now. And so should I go to end-to-end encrypted communication to protect that? Well, no, even if I said I just left a giant bag of $100,000 cash on this bridge by post number 4, can you pick it up sometime in the next 6 hours, Mario? The people who could, you know, who would care about that aren't in that network. The signal's not how I avoid them. Text is how I avoid those people, and not just talking about it, you know, at the bar. Like that's how I avoid the people that are going to steal the suitcases of cash. No, what are we doing?
I do agree, but I just don't like the idea. I mean, DHS is telling us that the Chinese, Russian, and Iranian government agents are tapping into this information, and I think we should be all concerned with it.
From a national security perspective.
From a national security perspective. And mm-hmm. I also think I debate the whole privacy, whether privacy exists on the internet or even on any other stuff. And we all know privacy doesn't exist necessarily. But I just feel when you have these adversaries mining data from all of us, I just don't feel comfortable with it.
If I'm sending or someone that I've elected is sending some data on where to ship the attackums to and what train they're going to be on, I don't want them using SMS, like full on. That's what I'm worried about being on there. But if you're not doing that, and now you're going to burn your cycles shifting you and especially your employees at a bank or at a whatever manufacturer because of this guidance, I think that's misguided when you should be, you know, configuring your cloud infrastructure securely. So looking at this article that we had shared about some DHS guidance on this, they had 8 takeaways. And one of them, first of all, this kind of harkens back to what I was talking about with the somewhat confusing remit of CISA. Right, so in the article, it mentions attacks that were targeting senior government officials and politically active folks. And then it goes on in the recommendations to only use end-to-end encrypted communications. I think they cite Signal as an example of that.
I think these general recommendations that they're making here, we could all probably use not just on a business level, but also personal level, we could use and leverage some of these recommendations, maybe not all of them, but some of them do. The use of password manager makes total sense. You've heard me talk about using FIDO2 to do phishing resistant authentication. I mean, those are legitimate things that we should all be thinking about, and also encrypting our communications. Hey, I use Signal, so I don't know how bad Signal is, but I use Signal.
So the other consideration is not just the message security itself. So one of the other things that is also communicated across the SS7 network is which cell tower you're connected to at that point in time. So you can imagine if I wanted to get some level of real-time approximate location of where you are, then the SS7 network is a great channel to be able to pull that, because that's the whole point of the signaling, the signaling that's happening. It's a control network that says, here's how I deliver a call to you. So that's something to be, going back to the Jerry, your point about who this guidance is geared towards. If you care about executive protection and where they physically are at any particular point in time, then that is definitely a concern for you as well. It's hard to avoid this now. In fact, the person I know that has done supposedly a really good job of this is a investigative reporter that when I asked, he's taken himself completely off the grid and has gone through many other legal mechanisms to avoid any trace of his name appearing anywhere in any document that indicates where he lives. And one of the things he told me one time was, don't ever give your actual phone number out, unless it's a burner phone that you don't ever plan to have associated with anything that's even close to your actual location. So that was a suggestion. Don't give your phone number out if you are, which kind of is ridiculous, obviously, in the real world, right? Mm-hmm. If you want to actually receive any phone calls, then you kind of have to have your phone number given to somebody. But that's the suggestion mm-hmm. that was given to somebody who really wanted to be off the grid.
Yeah, I think this just goes back to there's this problem with us as security professionals in general that we are perversely incentivized to just cover all the bases on the recommendations and say, like, well, here's a million things that you should do. And you're like, well, I can't do it. Well, hey, when you get burned, I'm going to take out this list and show which ones you didn't do and show how you're negligent and I know everything. And that's not what people are hiring us for. I mean, I think when we say, like, you can wait on that. I mean, that's not a big deal. That's when we're really providing value. And like, so, you know, thinking about that list of 8 things that CISA said, number 8 was my favorite. because finally someone came around. I mean, we've been
that was the same side, Jerry. That was my favorite as well, Jerry. Yes.
Don't use these stupid VPNs. Yes. And how many lay people are routing their traffic through Romania instead of just because they don't trust AT&T or whatever it is? So
or the freebie ones, right? Just go use their free services for VPN. Well,
no VPNs. Yeah,
So let's be clear on what the recommendation is. So first of all, the recommendation is do not use a personal VPN. Mm-hmm. But I don't think actually the word personal is the right word to use, because guess what? I actually have a personal VPN that I've set up myself, you know, using WireGuard, whatever. Yeah. But the ones that they were referring to is the VPNs that you can, you know, all the ads that you see on a YouTube. Like all my kids know about one of these VPN providers. I'm not going to mention them just because I don't want to give them more shout out.
Yeah. But that's what people think VPN is. They stole the term.
Yeah, there is. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. But those are not the ones. Those are the ones that they're suggesting not to use. Do not use one of those VPNs.
I think a better way to, like, we're never going to win this, but to win the semantic battle would have been know where you're tunneling to. Only tunnel the places you want to.
That's too technical for most people, Jerry.
I know. Sunil, you're saying you're going to tunnel from when you're in Greece, I'm just guessing arbitrarily, that you're going to tunnel to your house so you can get to your whatever.
That's right. A note that I'm fully in control of.
But don't tunnel to a random stranger, criminal's computer. And that's what these VPNs are.
Yeah.
Or put another way, use a VPN when you're trying to get to something that's not otherwise available. Don't use a VPN to try to hide from anyone. That's stupid. Stupid, because just saying it's not a great idea hasn't worked. So that's everybody. CISA is now agreeing it's stupid to try to hide from the man with a VPN, and it gets you in a lot more trouble than it saves you from.
I'm glad we're debating this one, because I honestly, it was like, well, could that be my own personal VPN that I've installed at home? Is that what they mean? Or do they mean the ones, the free ones out there? So I'm glad we're debating that, because it was a little bit unclear to me. So I'll say that, but I agree with all of us on this
don't
topic.
VPN for privacy, VPN for access. Yeah. All right. Pretty cool. We keep abreast of some threat intel and actual incidents and read through them, and if there's some novel TTPs, we bust it out. And there was this pretty cool one just in December about Radiant Capital, so crypto. And there was a few interesting facets to this. One that I'll talk about in a moment is just the crypto threat perspective, and harkening back to what I said a moment ago about knowing the audience and who's being threatened by whom. Crypto is really unique, and they're tip of the spear. But then there's also some stuff about the TTPs here, huh? And Mac malware, is that novel in your mind? Is that a watershed moment?
I think there are a couple things to note here. One is that when it comes to targeted attacks against crypto firms, companies, I mean, there's a very clear motivation, enough of motivation to warrant a targeted attack with custom designed malware of some sort. What's interesting about this one is a couple different things. One is that as you may expect in many of these crypto companies and startups and such, many people use Macs, right? So this was a Mac malware. And for all of us in security who think Macs are hardened against malware, this is just an indicator that it's not as hardened as we like to think. But on top of that, anyone who's used CrowdStrike or SentinelOne or in EDR on a Mac knows that it doesn't really work that well. I don't know. At least that's my opinion. Okay, so what does work, but is extraordinarily annoying. Okay, if you do it really well, it's something like LittleScript, because LittleScript would have said, hey, you have something trying to communicate with atokyonews.com, and do you want to allow that? And if you're assuming that you're paranoid enough to not just allow everything forever, this would have flagged it, and you would have said, oh, what's going on here? But again, it's super hard to manage and super hard to use. But the point is, at the end of the day, we have, while, yes, Macs are generally less targeted just in general compared to Windows, it's certainly a strong indication that it's not, it's not completely foolproof. And when it fails in such a way that it leaves very little trace. And I think that's kind of the whole point of the incident update. When the incident first was talked about in October, they didn't know, though. It was hard for them to understand the origin. So the fact that it took them 2 months to get to the point where they said, yep, here's where it was, is a strong indication of just how hard it is to find some of these backdoors in the Mac environment.
Hey, so you'll clear some for me. This wasn't necessarily, though, a vulnerability against a library of the operating system. It sounded like the person who was type of phishing attack. You open a zip file, underneath that there was an Apple script, a script like a bash script that runs on your Apple to then send a communication outbound, maybe HTTP, HTTPS, and then download badness back into your system. But it wasn't anything. So it was exploiting the logic of the operating system, Apple script. But it wasn't a library vulnerability like traditional like a when I think of Windows malware, for example. Do you remember what this was? The form of the.
Now I have to go back and look read the postmortem to figure out what it actually did.
But you see my point, right? Because I think this. So I will be. I hate to admit this. I've said this in previous episodes, right? Because I don't want to get into this whole operating system jihad. But I've through years learned. I can't believe I'm saying this. I do believe Mac OSs tend to be more secure than their counterparts. I've heard the arguments to Neil and Jerry. There's more Windows out there machines. As an attacker, I'm going to go after the big prey, after the big group of users, as opposed to a smaller users of Mac. But the Mac users tend to be in the Valley and in the West Coast, tend to be engineers, security people, people that if you do pop them, they might get you the keys inside the kingdom of that place. So I don't think Mac OSs are necessarily less. I continue to believe they are more secure. I think this form of attack is one leveraging the logic of the operating system, not a flaw.
It was a $50 million payday. So, and it was supposedly DPRK, so North Korea doing this. And so to me, going back to the soapbox I'm always on, if you have $50 million of liquid crypto capital that can be exfiltrated with RCE, then look out, because DPRK is sniffing around and they're doing their homework and they're investing months. And the social engineering that went into this, the whole kill chain, they found someone who had left the organization recently and they impersonated them. And I mean, we've all worked at places and had people come and go. If somebody left and then they reached out to you, it's a perfect prescript, right? Because they can come to you from any Outlook or Gmail. You're like, oh, well, that must be Joe's personal email address, right? I only talked to him at work, and now he's gone. Of course it's a new email address. It's just really perfect. And it said, look at this report I'm working on, and it was a hacking analysis report around like a crypto heist, which is pretty sophisticated. So the conversation was among people who are protecting organizations from this type of thing anyway, which makes it very confusing to analyze the intel on it. And then in the process of reading the report, they executed the malware that established C2 on these boxes. And what they ultimately did, and I know this really well because I saw this firsthand in a red team engagement where you had 4Eyes or 6Eyes controls over payments, where one person couldn't create a payment on their own. They could just prepare it. And then there was a second person that had validate it, and then a third person had to finally agree to it. That has existed in traditional finance for a long time, and it's a real tenet of crypto transactions. So not one person can be abused here. And what I saw firsthand in a red team, it was a cross-site scripting attack. So the UI for the internal approval app, and by the way, for anybody who's not working in financial services, the internal apps that the employees are using to move money around are going to be the last thing to get, UI sophistication or pen testing or anything like that, usually for good reason. But in this case, they basically, one person would see a transaction and then route it to the next one, and the next one would, what do? You have to review it and read it and then ultimately say yes or no. And it's so simple if you think back on it. They used a cross-site scripting vulnerability to basically, with JavaScript, re-render the whole thing. So it was a different transaction was what they were seeing in the UI. And it said something pretty innocuous. Actually, in the one I saw on the red team one, they had messaged them and said, hey, I'm putting in a test transaction. You can just reject it. Very routine. And when the thing rendered, the reject button was the word reject was rendered over what was actually the approve button. So the user said, okay, cool. They just hit the reject. And really, they were approving a transaction. And that was on the Swift network, actually. No fault of the Swift network. The exact same thing from what I'm reading here, where they basically said, here's this either low-value transaction or something routine. Person looked at it and hit OK. And then that engaged with their hardware wallet, like TPM-type technology that is, it's the state of the art. We're not going to disclose our keys. Yeah, that worked great. Didn't disclose any keys. But it dutifully signed the transaction this user told it to sign, because that's what they have the right to do.
Jeez.
Just by messing around the render layer. And look, everybody, if you're at any of the, I always say the long tail, the 99% of companies in the world, if you think this is what you're up against, don't worry. You're not. Even if you're at a venture firm and doing large wires, which are pretty targeted for wire transfer, all that, even those threat actors are not doing this kind of thing. They're not doing the social engineering, understanding the relationships, putting in malware, understanding the internal apps, changing the render layer. If they were, then all that crap about it's not if but when would be very true. But fortunately, there's usually not a confluence of this level of sophistication and persistence and the types of targeting that we see out there. So I think this is great for people to understand what crypto's up against. And by the way, if you're hiring people in cyber, look at crypto, because they've been through the ringer. They're battle tested for sure. But I don't think that everybody in the world has to worry about this. Do they have to worry about the Mac malware, though? Maybe. I mean, it depends on how it really executed, if it had a true leg up or not. All right, speaking of North Korea. So that saga continues, and there was a pretty detailed indictment out. And this is kind of following up. We've talked about this in previous episodes about the DPRK kind of fraudulent employee schemes, which were really motivated towards just getting salary back to North Korea. And they were doing legitimate programming work. And I even knew someone personally who got a call from the FBI and had to unwind an employee that it turned out to actually be North Korea. And their take was, wow, what a shame. They were a good engineer. We have a tough time replacing them. They were doing good work. And I think the majority of the attacks, people said, they don't seem to be stealing data for North Korea's strategic gain. But they are stealing money to avoid sanctions, and that's bad too. But it's almost like the PII, and that without the regulation, people wouldn't care. That's probably true here too. Without the sanctions, companies would probably be happy to pay North Korean nationals to work for them. So that's where we were. The update here in this indictment, though, is that while there isn't stealing data to submarine the company for North Korea or something like that, there was, once people figured it out and they fired these folks, and it wasn't necessarily because they knew that they were from DPRK. It was just because they weren't doing a good job, or they didn't really show up, or whatever it was. Then they were coming back and extorting them now. And that was the twist in here. So these North Korean nationals through pseudonyms in the U.S., were getting hired, fired, and then saying, if you don't pay me, and by the way, this isn't $50 million. It was $2,000, $2,500, $10,000. If you don't pay me that, I'll leak this data. And if you go through the details on this, a few of them tell them to get stuffed, but at least one of them, a not-for-profit, paid to keep the data secret. And I immediately think, is this like for $2,000? Does that mean that one of these actors is kind of like going out from under their commander and just trying to pocket $2,000? But apparently they had some competitions there of who can, for the mother country, have the biggest haul. And so it was this wild desperation is bringing money any way they can.
But here's the, for me, the takeaway I would have from this, which is we've already heard a number of stories where you have employees moonlight and they work 2-3 jobs, especially during COVID. And there's certainly significant concerns around whether that's even legal or that's allowed, but also the question of, okay, what happens when you have intellectual property potentially commingling on the same person's machine, all these other sort of things. I think while the North Korean issue here is prominent because it's North Korea and it's a sanctioned country, and you know all the bad aspects of working with North Korea. There is a bigger problem that I think most enterprises have, which is this issue with an employee potentially having multiple jobs, right? Or having some sort of indication that, how do you have an indication of any sort? Where are the observables that help us know that such activity is happening in this sort of scenario where you can have a remote worker essentially pretend to be working for you when they're actually working for somebody else? Okay, that's the bigger question I would ask. And now let's put that in the context of, let's say, like return to office, okay? Or let's put that in the context of like insider threat tools, or in the context of just additional monitoring that you may want to impose. This is an interesting problem, but how do you think we're going to try to fix this problem? Is it an indication of a much bigger issue, not just with North Korea, but just people working remotely? And what's the solution that you think enterprises are going to take? Return to office is one of those. But you can also imagine, you know, intensive monitoring that may not be all that great either.
Wait, are you thinking, we go back to work. I'm an employee. I'm an engineer. But I'm also going to work at home because, you know, hey, I really care about my job. And so I'm going to hire a North Korean partner to do this, all the work for me, all the development work for me at home. So if I'll go to work, show up, look around like I'm actually busy, but I'll do all the, I'll just contract it out for, what is it, 180,000, maybe five, maybe I can negotiate 10,000 with my North Korean counterpart. Like, hey, 10,000.
Yeah. Well, I guess the point is you can only show up at one place at least. So at least you got that problem cut down.
Not unless you can find a way to tunnel their traffic to their interactions to your computer somehow, right?
I think that the natural question that listeners would have is, what can we do about this? How can we stop it? And in an absolute sense, I think it's what you just stumbled upon, which is people are supposed to show up. And that's not really the trend, generally speaking. So are we at an impasse?
I wait for the system, the overlay, a physical overlay that's internet connected, that allows a remote person to type on a machine and move somebody's mouse, right? And so you just say, okay, hey, who wants to do my work for me for, you know, $80K a year for my $300K a year job, and whoever can do the work for me most efficiently gets the work, right? But it's done at the office because I have this physical overlay I can put on my computer.
You know, I think we should talk about this maybe in a future episode. We are seeing people going back to work, even in startups in the Valley. Okay. In San Francisco, you just look at the headlines. The real estate, commercial real estate is kind of going back. It's not back where it was before pre-COVID, but it's trying to go back up. And a lot of it, AI, you hear AI companies, a new bubble, I'm going to get in a new internet bubble, blah, blah, blah. But anyway, people are going back to the offices, and we're seeing that. And that's, I'm not even talking about the big companies, guys.
I'm not talking about the public companies. Literally in a startup office that's in person with everybody here in Atlanta. But you saying it from the Valley, that's really interesting.
Just from the people I talk with, people that are like, look, you know, just gotten hired, and I'm talking startups, guys. I'm talking 10, 20 people startups where they're actually going to the office in San Francisco.
North Korea.
$2,000, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Well, that's really interesting. That's something we should keep an eye on and ping people about, without a doubt. All right. Well, awesome, guys. We're up against it, and we're all about to jump back into holiday. So please enjoy your time away. Enjoy some downtime. Finally, thanks for playing along, and we'll see each other in the new year, huh?
Thanks for having us.
Merry Christmas. Happy holidays.